Hey guys, I've told you about it before, but I'm telling you about it again. Stitcher is smart radio, on-demand news, talk, and more for your mobile phone or pad. Stitcher brings radio and podcast listeners a better way to listen to their favorite shows and helps them discover new content by delivering personalized audio streams on demand right to your smartphone. How Did I Get Here, along with over 5,000 other shows, is on Stitcher. You can listen to us on your iPhone, on your Android phone, on any of the pads. Stitcher Smart Radio for your phone. Find it in your app store at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I have a great show for you today, but before we even start talking about it, I need to thank all the people that gave me all the feedback about the Zach Loy episode, the last episode. That was a great conversation I had with Zach, and yes, I knew him for a long time. I've known him for a long time. He's a great guy. He's up in New York right now playing with Ed Kowalczyk this weekend. So thanks to all of you and all the new listeners. If you're still sticking around, you're still listening, thank you for sticking around. You know, this show, I talk to musicians, I talk to all kinds of people in the music business. I find all kinds of different, I find them all different kinds of ways. Like I find a story on social media and I'll reach out to the person and be like, hey, I see you're putting out a record. I heard a song off it. It sounds great. Come on over. Well, last Saturday I was sitting around, I woke up and I turned on the news. And I'm sitting there watching the news, and they're like, well, next up, we're going to talk to Martin Theophilus, the president of the Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording. And then this guy comes on. He starts talking about how he has this museum, but they don't actually have a physical museum place yet. All of this, like 180, over 180 tape machines are at his house, all different kinds. These are artifacts, okay? And they started an Indiegogo campaign that'll be up until August 20th, 2014, because the current museum is at capacity and nothing else can even come in. People want to donate stuff, but they can't even take it. They need some kind of storage space, but they need to find some way to pay for it. So that's what the Indiegogo campaign's for. So I freaked out, because if this was an actual place that you could go to, like this museum, bring in your friends when they come from out of town, I would go all the time. So I reached out to Martin. And I said, hey, man, I know you got this Indiegogo thing. I have a music podcast where I talk to people in music, and I want to help spread the word about this and help make this Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording a real thing that we can all go to. So he was like, yeah, sure. And he came over. And wow, he was an interesting guy. He came over with his wife, Chris. They sat down. I talked to him mostly. And he told me how he started the museum, what they're trying to do, what their ultimate goals are. And it's totally fascinating. It's incredibly interesting. And if you are somebody that is involved in recording, you're going to love this interview. And also you should go look this up. You should look up MOMSR, Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording.org. And they have a link to their Indiegogo project there. You can go there and watch the film, find out what they're all about, watch a film about Martin talking about all this stuff and showing you around all the tape machines and microphones that they have. It's pretty interesting, man. And I had a great time talking to him. So, sit down. I'm going to be talking to Martin in just a minute. Let me tell you what's going on with me. I played on Tuesday at Strange Brew. I did my residency there. I played with Salim Nirala and with Jason Blum. Salim Nirala brought along Joe Reyes from Buttercup, and we had a great show, man. It was fantastic. And, you know, I'm looking forward to doing another month of those. I've got this show this week. It's not really the residency I'm playing, but I'm opening for Steve Poltz. He's coming in from out of town, so I gave him that night. And he said, sure, why don't you come open for me? So I'm going to be doing that. If you're in town, if you like Steve, he's one of my favorite performers, and I'm very excited to be getting out there and playing with him. Also, I'd like to thank everyone who downloaded my song Among the Swells and Tides from my SoundCloud page yesterday. If you want to check it out, I've got like 5 songs there that are available for free downloads. I'm putting one song up every week. Go to soundcloud.com/Johnny Gowdy and check it out. All right? Whew, that's a lot. Let's talk to Martin Theophilus from the Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording, all right? Let's get down. So the Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording.
Yes, what a name.
What a name. I don't even know where to start. You guys are started an Indiegogo campaign.
Yes, we did.
To raise funds for a physical location, for a storage space.
Right.
Explain.
Okay. Let me back up just for a second,
okay.
Because when we started the collection, I never had any intention it was going to be something like this. And then we ended up getting some things that were more significant. And about 2 years ago, 2012, I started thinking about, what's Chris going to do with all this crap?
Yeah.
So I saw her selling it off on eBay, and we'd already thought about willing it to somebody, and we didn't really find anything. So we went, looked at several museums. We had a chance to go out to the Grammy Museum. We did some other, I'd seen the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I kept thinking, man, there's no tape recorders or really engineering stuff. It's very musician-centered, which is good. But I really felt like the Grammy Museum went and did a demonstration for Beyonce, and they started saying, well, this is what she'll sound like. This is what she sounds like on a cylinder recorder. Acoustic, and then they went to vinyl, what she'd sound like on a record back
right,
then,
right.
And then they jumped to cassette, and
yeah.
They just bypassed wire and reel to reel and that. And so I felt like we really ought to make this a recording technology museum. And so we decided to create it, founded the nonprofit, and I was on my way to see Casey Monahan at the Texas Music
yeah.
Office, and I told Chris, I said, you know, people are not going to flock to Austin to see a bunch of reel-to-reel recorders. We're going to have to do something else with this. So we started talking to Casey and said, you know, it really ought to be the things that impact, that sound recordings impacted by, which primarily in Austin would be music, but it's also broadcasting and science and other things. And Casey said, you know, people have tried to do this before, but they've never been able to pull it off. And the more we got into it, we found, and I don't know who all the people were, but evidently they've had some really good funding background and funding backing, but evidently some turf issues and that got into it, so it never made it happen. So we're trying to just say, you know, we really do believe that Austin should have a world-class music museum that includes the recording technology and broadcasting and that. And we've gotten a good response. We founded the Indiegogo thing because we suddenly started getting offers for significant things like the audio, of all things, control things that did the animatronic things at,
yeah.
at Orlando and that.
Yeah.
And that company didn't want to junk it. They felt it ought to be preserved because it was some significant things. We just don't have room for something like that. And I had the first...
So it's all just in your house.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's in a home studio. We actually built the second floor studio to be also a place to display it and have a museum.
Okay.
And it is set up like a museum. It's set up where all the recorders that are working, which is like 80% of them, are tied through various sound systems so that you can play them, you can demonstrate them, you can...
How many recorders do you have right now?
We've got 180 right now.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I say that, and a lot of people don't realize, because there's a lot of collectors, and there's a lot of people that have a couple of hundred recorders, and they've gone more quantity than very specific things. My whole thing from the very beginning has been, when I first started doing recording in 64, was to help musicians develop their music. That's how I got started. The first guy I worked with for a summer in 64 went to a studio in San Angelo and recorded their demos, and I helped him develop their songs. Well, the studio in San Angelo had just done The Cavaliers with Last Kiss, number one, and I went, oh my God, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so everything since then has been basically trying to do things that help musicians develop. And so
just a quick question.
Yeah, sure.
How in the world, like in 1964, how did you even know engineering was a job? I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's hard to figure out. I knew a guy, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but he got into the music business because he saw a picture of the Beatles. And there were these two other guys with suits standing with them.
Right.
And they were like, who are those other guys?
Right.
And they were like, that's the manager. And he's like, okay, that's okay.
Right.
So
right.
That's what I'm going to do. So
right.
How did you even know it was a job?
I think in Alpine, it was hard because there wasn't a lot of things out there. There wasn't a lot of people doing that. I guess it was because of the radio station. I had a friend in high school who got asked to come in and do some DJing for the local radio station.
Okay.
And a couple of you saw it. Yeah, so a couple of those DJs started inviting me, and suddenly they couldn't get rid of Martin at the radio station.
Right.
I was always there working with tape machines and that. And then when I got into high school, They bought a new Sony recorder, and I was the one that got excited about it and started doing it. So I did all the high school recordings, like from 62 to 64.
Like band and right. choir and stuff like that?
Band, choir, yeah, and dance bands okay. back then. And then the same thing happened in college. I majored in music. I was a trumpet player, but I swear I probably would have never graduated if I didn't have a recorder with me all the time, because that's why I got to go. And the coolest thing, about having that in college was that I did all the concert tours for the band.
Right.
And doing the concert tours, the band director had these two 30-foot microphone poles that right. we could put up. Well, those had to be taken in the college station wagon. So I would get to not – I didn't have to ride in the bus. I got to take the college station wagon with all the equipment, a couple of friends of mine and mine, and we could go eat anywhere we wanted to.
Right.
And then go set up the recording, and then we'd do the band tour. So I did the band tour and started doing records through that time, which actually got me hired – for Austin Custom Records to do on-location stuff around Texas.
Oh, wow.
So I was producing albums for them around the state. And I'd do the masters and then send them to Austin Custom Records and they'd press.
Wow.
And so I came to Austin in 68 and I knew I had to be here. I was working also for the state at the time. All the recording stuff was in the evening and weekends, which worked perfectly. So I had a full-time job all the time with the state.
What were you doing with the state?
I was doing child protective services.
Okay. It wasn't anything entertainment oriented. Or
no, it okay. wasn't. Okay. No, it was so different. And it was so cool because if you looked at my work history, child protective services was intense, very little recording going on.
Yeah.
But most of the state work was not that intense.
Right.
And the recording stuff was just flying at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
so I knew I wanted to be in Austin, and it took me 10 years to get here, 78. And I came in, my first location job was at Antone's doing some reggae bands, and met some, you know, other people, met a producer named Peter Butcher, who was from England, who did all kinds of things. And it just went crazy. And then I met this lady, and she just jumped right in. Never been involved in the music industry, now booking hundreds of events a year and
oh, yeah?
working with all kinds of people.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was from the engineer standpoint that I was just trying to help musicians with their stuff and let them hear something and trying to save them money before they went into the studio. And then I got into managing, and then we got into video and helping them more, but we were just pouring money at it. And suddenly we were at Medem in France. And we were representing a whole bunch of Texas music, Bobby Bridger and all kinds of people, and Stephen Fromholtz. And we were pitching their stuff, and this Canadian group said, "My God, Chris, you're doing an excellent job in pitching. Are you making any money at it?"
Yeah.
"Well, no, we're trying to manage. We're like investors." And they
right.
said, "You need to do corporate stuff." And she came back and suddenly connected with David Perkoff Music, and then they were doing like 500 events a year for mostly corporate stuff, but big groups. I mean, Helen Reddy and... I can't even mention everybody.
Christopher Cross.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
So to say that, I get back to what you were saying about the collection. My collection is really concentrating on the multi-track machines that musicians use.
Right.
And things that were of significance. It's not just to have a bunch of recorders sitting around. I can tell you probably on every one of them why it's in that collection. It's not just because it happened to arrive or something.
Right.
And it's everything from... the Ampex 200A, which is very rare. There's very few of them around the country. There's only 212 of them made. Ours is number 33. It belonged to Columbia Records. And it did the, it then went to a producer named Leo de la Gorka, who is called the Baron. And he did all kinds of Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra and stuff. And the funniest thing, Chris works with Floyd Domino a whole lot. And we had him over for an interview, and it was really funny. He said, "Oh, my God, that machine, we demoed with Leo de la Gorka. I bet we demoed on that machine when Sleep at the Wheel was first getting started." So that made it kind of cooler.
Wow.
It also mastered Tequila, which was cool.
Wow.
But both of those came from Salinas, California, from a guy. Leo de la Gorka had some incredible machines, probably worth $500,000. And this engineer out there mother was friends of his widow, and decided to sell them to him for like $10,000 or something.
Right.
And he was selling it off. And I saw it go by on eBay and went, "My God, nobody bought that?"
Yeah.
And it went by again. I said, "Chris, I'm on my way to Salinas." And the thing's 240 pounds. It's a stainless steel top and everything. Barely get it into the car when I was coming back. And sorry, I'm not meaning to go on and on this, but Johnny,
that's what this is all about.
Okay.
Go ahead. I love this.
Engineers listening will love this. So I see that he's got the Ampex 200, but beside it, he's also got the 300, which was their next one up.
And I it's a two-track?
Yeah, it's okay. Mastering. Okay. Yeah, and the 300 was too. And, I mean, the 200, I shouldn't even probably say, but it was $500 on eBay, and nobody else had bid. I know. I mean, it's probably worth, you know, $25,000 or something. So as I'm getting ready to leave, I said, man, I'd love to have that 300. And he said, there's no way I'm letting that go, you know, for less than, you know, $5,000, $6,000. I said, okay. So we got the one loaded, and I got ready to leave. And he said, you know, Martin, these two recorders have been together their whole life. I'm going to let you have it for the same price.
Oh, right.
So he did. But I thought, that's really an affection auto. But he had Stevens and 3M machines and all kinds of stuff. It was amazing to see the stuff. I wish we could have added more. But that, and then some others that we came into, we've got like a really early Willie Studer. Willie Studer was asked by an undertaker in Switzerland to work on a machine that he'd bought from America from Brush back in 1949, 50. And he said, can you rebuild this for our market? And he evidently started working on it and said, you know, I really can't. It's too far away from what we need to do with our cycles and our electricity. And I think at some point he called it a piece of junk. But again, Brush was doing some good jobs in the U.S. And so he rebuilt it to his own specs, and the guy said it's going to go wild, and they built 500 of them. It was Willie Studer's first machine.
Oh, wow.
And so, of course, it turned in. So we got one of those. We've got a Dynavox, one of his first. Looks just almost like the Brush machine. And then we've got his later stuff. We've got some of his Reebok stuff, and we've got Studer A807, which is a real cutting-edge kind of thing. So there. Grief. I don't know if you can shut me up. It's hard to.
No.
All these tangents.
So let me go back to what you're going to use the money from the Indiegogo for. You're going to try and get a location or secure a location.
What we're doing first is just some storage, because we're getting offered these big things and we're having to pass on them. We had to pass on a machine that was recording Roy Orbison early on, and it was just too big. I mean, we are, if you come out, which we'd be glad
what
to have you come
shame.
Out.
Shame.
We're just out of space.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing we want to do. The other thing is, like, somebody had a collection of a whole bunch of Nagger recorders, and some of those would be really great, and I think she would like to donate those when we get to a facility.
Right.
But this place in Orlando would like to, I think they'll pay for shipping, but we've got to have some place to do it. So the storage base became obvious. And as we got approved by our nonprofit, by the IRS, we suddenly started getting all these offers. And we've got a real, I guess, fairly strict guideline about what we will accept and what we won't. It's got to fit into the collection for some reason. And it's got to be...
Has to be a magnetic recording device.
It doesn't have to be. No. We've expanded that. We think the museum should start with acoustic and go all the way through digital. I think that's what's going to be interesting to people. Chris does a little summary of the history of sound recording on a DVD collection that I meant to bring you, and I'll send you one.
Yeah, please.
But the very first recording was done on a cylinder that was wrapped with some paper and covered with soot from the fireplace. And there was a needle put on it. It was played back. Nothing could be played back. All it could be was recorded. And this is late 1800s. It wasn't in 2000.
Wait, how did you know that it was recorded? Oh, because it was physically on there?
It was physically on. You could see it.
Okay, because if you can't play it back, how do you know it's there?
No, right, exactly.
Right, right. Okay.
So they, in 2008, there's a group called the Sound Group or something like that. Anyway, they digitally captured it and played it back, and it turned out to be a French folk song. And then it also had a tone on it, and they've got recordings of these online. We've got it on our website. The tone on it was actually the tuning fork that the French used for their orchestras when they started.
Oh, wow.
And so they were able to find it. Yeah, sure. He did it. He was successful. He was able to capture the sound waves acoustically.
Wow.
So it was really fun. So I think that's where, I mean, I see when you walk into this museum, you've got this huge wall. One of the board members, our architect, Lloyd Cate, said, I see the very beginnings of sound, and then this huge mural, just the whole evolution of sound as it goes across.
Yeah.
And then you can go in and you can start looking at the different recorders, what came first, what the companies did. We're hoping to involve manufacturers in this. But then you can go into different areas of museums. Here's the music area. Here's stuff that Willie Nelson's done. Here's Stevie Ray Vaughan. Here's all the things where this acoustic stuff impacted him. Then you can go over here and do broadcasting, and you've got Dan Rather, you've got Cactus Pryor, you've got those folks. You can go into science. I mean, NASA just had an amazing... I didn't know for a long time when I was collecting that about half the real tape recorders were made for science, were made for hospitals for recording information, or were by NASA for telemetry.
Recording like physical information, like someone's heart?
And doctor's reports all kinds of stuff. Law enforcement with their tracking, logging recorders that are always going on, listening to everything that's going on. I'm sure NSA probably had some of them back then.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure those are the people that had the best ones.
Bet they did. Actually, we've got one of the recorders that Sony put out that was used by Nixon and his stuff. He played them back on Ewers, but it was a Sony 800B that actually did some of the recording. So we've got one of those in there.
Wow.
So there's some... I'm pretty excited about it. We've tried to involve a lot of people. I'm an engineer, not a salesperson.
Right.
And even though we put the information out there, we're having trouble moving people to the point that they would help it with us. And, you know, it may not be that the storage space is really exciting. The other part of that is people...
No, but you'll be able to start building your...
Right. We'll have the collection where we're not losing these things that are going away.
Right,
And to help people with shipping. And then the other thing is just to be able to respond when something like a Roy Orbison recorder comes along. Because, I mean, nobody was donating that. We were going to have to buy that, and we didn't have the funds to do it, so we were looking for that. I guess my dream had been that as we started this was just kind of a minor Indiegogo, but I really was hoping that we would maybe put it over the top and all of that could start moving toward the bigger picture.
Location, yeah.
But people also that we've been meeting with say you really need to attract people that have been successful in the Austin music scene that would engage with it also. And even corporations that are successful here making Austin happen need to get back engaged in the music community.
Seems like something Ray Benson would be super into.
Ray is super into it.
Okay, yeah, seems like his dream thing.
Yeah, yeah. We've talked to him several times, and he's been invited to come over, but, I mean, it's like, what is it they call kitchen cats? Ray is all over the place out there.
Yeah.
And there's a whole nother part of this that deals with, and you'll see the interviews on our website, it's the people we're losing. It's not just the machines. It's the people that started all of this that we're losing.
Right.
And we were really lucky. In fact, while we were out at the Grammy Museum is we got to go interview Robert Metzner, who did early Caliphone recorders, which anybody that was in school or industrial stuff, that was the AV equipment you used with Caliphone. And then he started Robert's recorders because he had seen a motor on a turntable that came from a Kai, and he really was fascinated by it. He asked him if he could sell it or if he could copy the specs. Started a dialogue, and they said they would build machines for him. And so they sent him a couple of things that were pure junk, he said. So he sent him an Ampex, and back comes this Kai recorder. It looks just like the Ampex on outside, but on the inside, it's not.
Right.
So he started working with him to do that, and really did a lot of very innovative patents. He kept a Kai out of North America till 1972 for his Roberts recorders.
Wow.
But early on in that, I think the funniest thing that happened, his son, who is a psychiatrist, Richard, told us that he went away to college, and they were like living in the outskirts of Los Angeles, and this is not a great area. Well, Rheem, the air conditioner company, found out that the federal government was offering $5 billion for educational AV equipment. And they looked around, they decided to buy Robert Metzner's company. And Richard said, here, I came back from school, and here they're in Beverly Hills in this mansion. But they kept Robert on, and we were under the impression, we went to interview him, that was his life, the recording, and it wasn't. He built sculptures. He patented, I couldn't believe it, he patented a vehicle back in the mid-50s that was a hybrid, gas, electric vehicle.
Right.
He took it to Detroit for several weeks, and everybody said, you know, gas prices are nothing, so, you know, we're not interested. But it ended up in the Peterson Automotive Museum. We went to see it, took some pictures.
Wow.
And he's just a fascinating guy. He and his son in the late 40s were going to put metal rods through the city of Los Angeles and then put big magnets in cars so that you could get in your car and read the newspaper and it would take you to work. I mean, it was the early kind of Google
future
self-driving. But he's 97 now and just still going strong. Really cool guy.
But we're losing that generation of guys.
We are. And another one that we'd had contact with was the MagnaCord founder. And his dad had Alzheimer's. He founded MagnaCord. And MagnaCord's one of the biggest American broadcast tape recorder manufacturers. And John Boyers was the last one, and he had Alzheimer's. And it was exciting because our DVD kind of brought him back to life when he saw our summary on their company.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only reason I'd contacted them is they had some beautiful old photos of their factories back in the 50s, guys building tape recorders, which is fun. But Dave is so committed to us being successful, this project. They're offering all their archives. John Stewart's brother, Rod, has offered us their archives. And I have a great conversation with Rusty Paul, Les Paul's son, who has the Octopus, the great big 8-track Ampex. And he said, you know, if you can get your facility going, you can have that for a while, you know, on loan.
Yeah.
So that would be fun. So there's so many things percolating.
I saw there used to be a place, I don't know if it's still there, but it was by where Rudamaya Coffee was. There was like a place that had worked on tape machines and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Pro Audio? No.
No, it's kind of like that, though.
Oh, okay.
But maybe it was Pro Audio.
Yeah, they were right down there. There's only one place in Austin that actually does repair, and that's Mr. Wizard on North Loop.
Oh, really?
And he is...
Oh, yeah, the guy behind the music store.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's snowed. I mean, he's... I think when you take something into him, he's looking at 2 or 3 months out before he can get something back to you. But he's so good because he'll evaluate the whole machine, and then he'll call you and tell you, you know, do you really want to do this? What's it going to cost? And that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, but that's the only person around here. I know we always are getting asked for repair stuff. And of all things, that's probably my downside. I can work with a lot of the mechanical stuff with recorders. But even though I was a ham radio operator and I took some electronics course, it just does not stick.
Yeah.
So the electronics part I've always had to go out and get help with. But I hope that would be also part of the museum, that we'd have a restoration area where people could actually watch them being restored and bring a lot of these even more to life, although most of them are really working well.
Yeah.
Surprising how many of them have been well taken care of when they come in.
Man, let me ask you this. Is there anybody making tape, manufacturing tape?
There's only one company, and that's Atari. And it's about $7,500. It's almost a custom thing if you order it. But that's the only ones. Somebody put a story up of someone else that was going to like try to come up the real high-end one, and I honestly don't remember what the name was. I remember looking at the link briefly. It looked like it was just very much in its early stages. And people had so much trouble after Ampex went out of manufacturing tape, and then Quantigy came up, and then they kind of went out. And now there's another company that's manufacturing tape. So that's always been a critical thing, too, is trying to get the tape going.
Yeah,
and resources. But there are so many good people. I mean, like Neil Young and his analog. He's analog on one side, and then he's doing the pano thing on the other side.
Yeah.
But it's fun. And I mean,
like Jack White has a thing where you record straight to vinyl, right?
Yes.
He's got a lathe there in the studio.
Yeah, that's really cool. I was looking at him. He's also working with the National Audio Federation Foundation, I can't think of the name of that exactly, which I didn't even know existed. It started maybe 3 years ago, but they are very much trying to preserve the audio in that, and Jack White's on their board as well as some other people. So that's a neat thing. We've connected with them, and he said, oh my God, kindred spirits.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure it's hard because it's a niche thing, but having all this access to gear and people ready to part with it,
right?
It seems like it would be, I mean, to me, I would go there all the time.
Yeah.
And every musician friend that came here, it'd be like, oh, you got to go check out the museum, you know,
right,
after
exactly.
sound check if you can, well, you know.
I was impressed that there's a man in San Marcos named Gary Hartman who has the Texas Music Roadshow.
Uh-huh.
And he put that in a Bullock in the fall of 2012, and they had 250,000 attendees. So the Bullock definitely perked up.
Yeah.
We did a project. We heard that the City of Austin Sea Home intake facility was going to be up for grabs. So we did a promotion. We got the most votes, got the most comments. They said, now you need to do the design part.
But you couldn't afford that.
We couldn't afford it. We tried to get with UT, and they said, oh, students are already committed and stuff. We couldn't, so we backed out of it. But that attracted the director of the Bullock Museum at that time to us. She contacted Margaret Koch, who is the director of exhibits at the Bullock, and she invited Chris and I up for lunch and took us around, and she said, you know, here's our music area. Well, it's about a 30-foot area that has CDs and stuff from like the Texas music 50s to the 30s to the 50s, I think it is. It's right by the Texan plane and a little NASA display. But she said, we're thinking about expanding this, and she said, you know, we might be able to take some of your things in display when we do that. And I think that night they had a board meeting, and they decided they're looking at the 2015-2016 period, and now they're really more on the 2016. They're very involved with the ship that's coming into the Forum area that was from LaSalle that they restored or were going to restore from the Gulf. But
so you basically right now what you need is storage.
We need storage, and we need folks to help us. UT has volunteered to do some of the interior design work in the spring of next year.
Right.
And that's going to be great, but they're going to need some funding to actually come out if they do models and that kind of thing.
Right,
we'll be able to need to pay them, so we're asking for some donation for that too. I think it's still a gauge to just see what's going to be the response. The intake facility in Austin garnered a lot of attention.
Uh-huh.
And this is too. I think we've had like 500 referrals to the Indiegogo thing, but again, we've only had like 14 donations. So it's like trying to help get people, even if it's a little bit, you know, it would help us to move it on.
So and those are the people that are listening now that would like to see it, even if they didn't live in Austin, they can just, like the Indiegogo thing you just set up, you just pay right there. It's like Kickstarter.
Right.
Or
exactly.
Like, I can't even remember any of the names of the other ones. But
it's like Kickstarter, except Indiegogo lets us keep the money if we what right. we get, so we can at least put some of it back in.
Right.
And the other thing, Johnny, I think is that musicians that are listening, that are working in bands and working with other people, especially if they might be working with significant people, to say, hey, would you take a look at this? I mean, because this is really cool what we're trying to do.
Oh, for sure. It seems like somebody like a help. Jack White or a Dave Grohl would totally freak out on something
right,
like this.
Right, and we've got feelers out to them. We've got feelers out to Willie Nelson. Even Dan Rather's folks, we've tried to let them know we'd really like to do this. So I don't know. Sometimes I get up in the morning and think, I wish I could just kind of relax, but it's like, as Chris will tell you, for the last 15 years, I've been wanting to make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, how did it start? It started with Chris giving you.
She gave me, we'd seen an Edison player in England right at the end of a vacation, because she's from England, and we just couldn't afford it. And we got back, and she got this one from eBay and gave it to me as a 2004 Edison. And almost a week later, I guess. Yeah.
19.
You're right.
1904. Sorry. Yeah. I was going to say, wow, she got it from the future?
Right.
Chris, we got to talk.
Right. So next thing I saw was a clip art on a Robert 770 that I wished I'd had back when. So I got that from a pawn shop in Phoenix. And then I said, Chris, you know, I'd really love to recoup some of the recorders I had. I had like 15, 20 I've worked with over the years.
Sure.
So we started doing this. All of a sudden, we acquired a great big Roberts that was a reversing reel-to-reel stereo, fast-forward, great. But you pulled up the head cover, and here's a black-and-white video head with a tape that you could reconfigure and record video. And it came out when the moon landing, of all things, for the timing.
Wow.
If you'd had it, you could have recorded the moon landing. It was the first consumer available. And that was by that Robert Metzger that came up with that. And then I think when the Ampex 200 came into the collection, we knew that we were into something that we need to be more significant.
Yeah.
And then the Studer arrived. We've got, that's when I mentioned the collection, as well as being geared toward what musicians use, we've also tried to get some of the first and last. We've got some of the first and last TAC, Tascans. We've got some of the first and last Sonys. We found TAC copied Ampex incredibly. That Ampex 300 I got, they came out with their first model. And of all things, I found it in San Marcos from a guy who had gotten it from Nashville. And it's the original recorder in its crate. It's never even been opened. We opened the top of the box. But we've never pulled it out or anything. So it's pristine, absolutely brand new. And we got another working one of that that was funny because it was from a sound company in Chicago, and they had it built into a great big wooden box. And on top, they'd mounted a refrigerator handle so they could make it portable. It's just, I mean, some of the stuff is just a hoot that comes in. I mean, it really is. So that,
yeah.
And microphones.
Yeah, let's talk about those microphones.
Oh, yeah. Whew. That we've been very lucky there. We're still looking for a Neumann. We need some Neumanns. But, we've got the RCA 770X. Actually came from Notre Dame, of all things, from there.
Is that the ribbon?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we've got a Sony C37A, which is just, I love that machine. That microphone. There's a funny thing about that. I guess I should digress for only a moment here. But there was knockoffs from that. When I first started out, I couldn't afford those guys. So I was buying Calrad microphones from Lafayette. And I had very early on, didn't use it very long, a Calrad 500C. And interestingly, we started noticing that those were being sold for like $50. So we started getting a few of them. And Chris said, boy, those are selling good. Those are helping us buy some of the equipment. I wish we could find like a whole crate of those. I swear, within a week, an electronics store closing out somewhere like St. Louis had a box of them brand new in the thing. And suddenly that was actually refinancing some of the museum to get it purchased. And some of those have gone through $350 now. And we've been asked to supply them to all kinds of New York Broadway things, to Tony Danza, it's just been really
fun. Danza, the guy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. For his show. Yeah. His assistant, he wanted a cool looking. It's only,
oh, yeah.
They were originally $5.95 and now they're buying them for a couple hundred bucks. And because of the collection, we've had requests from Sidney Pollockson contacted us for one of the brush recorders we had for making the Aviator, because they were working on the Aviator at that time. Uh-huh. And Howard Hughes had one of those. And we were just getting ready to involve that when they found it in Los Angeles. Said, I'd rather not ship it, and I've got it here, so cool. So it's kind of fun at least to see it in the movie.
Yeah.
But we get requests like that. And we used to loan stuff or rent stuff out, but it was just like pulling teeth to get some of the stuff back, and it would come back.
I bet.
Yeah, so we quit loaning out or renting microphones or anything. It just didn't make sense.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, when we get the museum going, we might do that, or we might also do transfers for people. We tend to not do transfers. We prefer them because it's so time-intensive, and with other stuff we're doing.
Tape transfers to digital?
Yeah, tape and wire transfers and everything. Do I have a second to tell you a quick story?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This is awesome, Martin.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I love talking to you. It's great.
This lady sent us a reel-to-reel tape from the 60s that she said had come from a boyfriend at that time, and she never had been able to hear it. And so I transferred it, and I went, oh, that's interesting. This guy's saying, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm in Vietnam. I haven't been able to get a hold of you. I haven't written or anything like that. It's because we've been really busy, so I thought, well, I'll record this tape for you. And I got your letter about you going out with Bill to the lake, and that's okay. It's no problem with that. And so I sent it off. I transferred it, and Chris here, and we got a real beautiful note back from her. She said that guy, John, was the love of my life. And when I didn't hear from him, I married this John guy, and I later found out he just passed away, and I was trying to find this other guy who only passed away 6 months before. That's why I wanted to get the tape transferred. I found out my mother had put him off. He'd come to my door when he got back from Vietnam, and she had never even told me he'd come. And I was like a week away from getting married. And she said it brought closure to me, but she said, there's a sad story here. And I went, that is a sad story.
So, wow.
Yeah.
You guys get a lot of stuff like that?
No, we don't.
Okay.
No.
I was going to say, wow, that's amazing.
Because we don't do much transfers, but that one did kind of strike home.
So were you planning on the when you do have a physical museum to have a recording studio in there?
Two.
Okay.
We want to have two studios, one that's 50s to 70s, and then one from the 70s to the 90s.
Okay.
And we want them to be workable, and we want them to tie to a soundstage that's also a theater. We have Lewis Myers, who's with South by Southwest.
Yeah, Lewis.
Lewis has all the original videotapes from ACTV stored.
No shit.
And
that is awesome.
He said he would make them available to us. And, I mean, we could run incredible things through that theater if we can do that. Plus, the theater would be a live performance stage tied to the studios.
Right.
Basically so people could see how it all works, but I could see it doing independent
special
projects.
Performances, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And recording them.
Right.
That'd be really cool.
I just can't imagine this space not being able to happen. I mean, I really can't. I can't believe that somebody won't step up and say, you know, we really need to do. Even talking to the Bullock, Margaret took us up to the third floor, and they've got 7,000 square feet of empty space. Chris has done events up there. But
I've played events there.
Oh, okay.
Skyrocket.
Oh,
not up in the thing, but in the entryway.
Oh, right.
This on the top? Okay, yeah. Wow.
But Margaret said 7,000 feet is not really that much. And she said she really sees us being more in an eclectic setting that has all kinds of space and can do the other things that really do music right, that do broadcasting right, that do the recording right. And all we really want to do is the recording technology, the sound technology part. And I would hope that people would step up and say, you know, I'd like to help coordinate the music part of this. Let's see if we can make it happen. The same thing with broadcast.
Like even something like the Antones Theater inside of the museum.
Yeah.
Like something that ties in, you know, to the roots of music here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Another guy that's come forward to us, and I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, Jim Rankin. came to us after.
That name.
Oh, he's
a guy.
He saw a video that KXAN did. I guess the first one that Jim Swift did, and he said, "I've got some radios that would look cool in a museum-like setting." So he came out and we talked to him. And how many radios do you have? I got 600 radios, vintage radios,
wow.
including like the Little Prairie, Little House on the Prairie ones, and the Waltons radio. That
wow.
So.
And the signs.
Yes. And so as we were talking to him, that sounded neat. I could see a wall of these old vintage radios. But he has old Austin radio station signs, the great big neon signs that he's restored.
Oh,
he's
that
got
is awesome.
A jukebox. He's got like a drugstore seating sets and table sets. I mean, all of that could be so cool to walk
stuff
into.
That, yeah, and you could even have like revolving exhibits too,
yes,
which would always
yeah.
keep it fresh. And,
right.
Oh, man, I'm excited about this.
Thank
<That's>
you.
What...
Some of his radios are actually at the San Marcos Audio
yeah.
Automobile Museum. He's got some of them down there, but I've got a lot of pictures on the website about them. But I think that's a fun. There's
yeah.
just some fun things that could be done with this.
Yeah, I want you to realize, both of you guys, to realize this dream and to add to the culture of this town. But mostly, I want to go there.
Thank you.
And
that's what we
friends.
Get from all over the world. I mean, that's our comments from all over
go
the
there.
World. They said, "I've got to get there. I've got to get there."
Yeah.
I mean, thank goodness it's online, but I've got to get there. And we see things like. Willie Nelson has a museum in Nashville. It's a general store. And he needs to be celebrated here so intently.
It's weird. He's in Nashville, like the place that
it's
never,
called a,
never really accepted him.
I know. And it's stuff that they came, it's like a gift shop, I guess, more
yeah.
than anything.
George Strait, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, George Strait. Yeah. I mean, we could have a lot of fun with this.
Yeah, totally.
There's also... a group called the Texas Music Museum that's been here for, what, 20 years or something like that? More than that. We went to meet with their board, and they were really excited about this. And I knew that they had a lot of old Texas sheet music and celebrations of really early Texas music.
Right.
But it turns out they've got a lot of the acoustical stuff that we don't have. That
oh,
we
wow.
could, that we could
yeah.
put together. And, I mean,
where,
that would...
Where is that museum?
It's on East 11th. And it's... Clay Sharkey said, who heads that, said that he has a lot of this stuff. He doesn't want to put it out because he's afraid it'll get damaged or stolen.
Right.
So you don't see it. But, they've been trying to do a place. And I think with that, there's also the South Austin Pop Culture Group that has the collection of posters from
the
Austin's
place,
music.
Like
forever.
Planet K or whatever?
Yeah. We've met with like Nick Barbaro with the Chronicle and
right.
stuff, who's such a cool guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Everybody we talk to gets really excited. I mean, Ray Benson got really excited about it, and he keeps planning to come over.
Right.
And we got Floyd Domino over, and Floyd interviewed with us, which was a hoot to hear
yeah.
how he got going. But it's a lot of fun. And I think we're trying to capture these interviews with these people, and we're also trying to get people to send us things about their first recording. And it's really funny to hear some people send us stuff that says, my first recording was this, and I thought, my God, I'll never want to hear myself again, and now they've got this great music career.
Yeah.
And that, and what the equipment they used, and it's fun to capture this stuff.
Yeah. It's weird. I'm a singer, and I've done this like since I was a kid, and I talk on this thing, and I still hate the sound of my voice.
When did you first hear yourself record?
Oh, early. I had like a tape recorder. My grandpa's reel-to-reel, like dictaphone thing, because he's a doctor. That was
oh,
the first
my.
Thing I actually used. That's funny you say that. Yeah.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
it had like a, almost like a CB,
right?
With like a curly
right.
thing connected to it,
right.
curly cord. Yeah.
How funny.
Yeah.
That's...
And I also found out through doing this show how many of us thought we invented multi-track recording before we knew what it was, because we took two, I wasn't able to play and sing a song at the same time. And then I realized, wow, I could play it and then put that cassette in the stereo and then put my boombox in front of it and then sing and then play a guitar solo when it came time for it. So...
Yeah.
Nico tells some adult that, and they're like, yeah, that's how records are made. You didn't just invent it.
I mean, it is so crazy. And people don't realize. We managed a band. We did manage Housewife's Choice. And one of their great saxophone player came back. He was studied musicology at UT and was really going into music, became a diplomat and assigned to the State Department in Africa. So
yeah.
But he came back with his daughter, and
this summer.
Yeah, this summer. And I mean, they came over and some of the other band came over and his daughter had never seen a recorder, didn't realize the tapes that's ready. I mean, she's a rower at UT and she was just captivated by the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, she'd heard her dad's stuff for the first time.
How long did people use? Because my grandfather had was he had a reel to reel, like consumer stereo, component,
right?
That you know he had some symphonies and stuff on, and I had a Batman, like album from the TV show,
right.
On there.
Oh, yeah. How funny!
Yeah, had like music. How long were those a thing?
You know, when they came out, things kind of languished in the 50s after Ampex started in the late 40s.
Right.
And you can look at some of the, in fact, if you look at what TEAC did, they came out with a quadraphonic. I think that was the funniest thing that happened.
Yeah, yeah.
They came out with quadraphonic and suddenly realized that musicians were rewiring their heads so that they could do sync track stuff.
Right.
And so we've got like, we've got pictures at least of the first ones that came out, which were quadraphonic. Then all of a sudden they said, oh, wow, you could do this. So they changed it a little bit. Then all of a sudden they said, oh, wow, okay. And the next time they came out, you could switch all the heads to do four-track syncing, which was really funny. And then they came out with a 2340, and then they went big time with multi-track.
So what you're saying is that essentially these came out and they were like consumer things, but then people figured out that at playback they would be two-track, but you could actually use them as a four-track recorder,
right?
If you wire them. That's
see, the awesome. Problem was you could do sound with sound,
yeah,
but they wouldn't be synced together
if you
recorded another one. So
okay.
By rewiring it, which is what they ended up doing, you could use a record head to playback, and then you'd be synced. And that's what Les Paul did. That's what Les Paul figured out in the beginning and got Ampex to build the Octopus.
Yeah,
and then he never recorded any music on it. It's like
really
well, he never released a record that was made on it, which is really strange.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet him?
Nope.
Have you met Rupert Neve?
Yes.
Seems like that he would be a guy that you'd want to have.
We're hopefully going to do an interview with him out at his factory, which is amazing to me. It's in Wimberley.
Yeah.
We went out to, and if you want to see a great studio, if you haven't seen it, Blue Rock with Billy Crockett and his wife Dodie. It's out in Wimberley. It's like Dodie and Dave and Billy were driving around on a motorcycle and came to this rock area by Wimberley. I thought, this is beautiful. Let's build a studio. And it's got living quarters for musicians and everything. So they bought Rupert Neve's brand new board and installed it about 6 months ago, maybe more than that. And Chris had booked a band out there for part of their party and everything. So we went out and we ended up walking in right looking at the console as Rupert was coming in to dedicate the board. And I had video, we always have video with us, so I videotaped it, and Billy and Rupert let me put it on the museum's website, because it's a wonderful story of him and how he got started doing what he does, doing the boards and everything.
Yeah.
But we want to have a more thorough interview with him. It'd be fun. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing that he's here in the area.
Yeah. Is Phantom Productions, that's what you guys book bands and do your events?
We, on there? Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Book things with David Perkoff Music.
Okay.
When we came back from that Meet M thing, and Chris said, you know, maybe I need to look into us making money with this music thing. She kept trying to book David's band, and they kept going back and forth. And so they were like the to-go band from Esther's. Esther's was doing, actually had a live band back then.
Esther's Follies?
Yeah. Had a live band. And David was the band leader, and they were getting requests to do on-location things with Esther's Follies. And the group was so busy with rehearsals and doing the performances, they didn't want to take a lot of it on. So David did and created this great resource of
Esther's to-go.
Right. And so when we met, we started talking, and we had put together all kinds of tracking stuff and management stuff and that, and it was like just a perfect marriage. So Chris started working with him.
23 years.
Wow. Yeah. The other side of Phantom is really video production and web production and stuff. In fact, this month is our 50th anniversary. This is the month I founded the company back in 1964.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's...
Congratulations.
I think so. Thank
you.
Yeah, never thought it would come to that. One of the interesting things is that studio engineers also, that was in San Angelo when I first worked with that band, they had Cavaliers and First Kiss.
Uh-huh.
He started another studio in Dallas, and then he started rebuilding Ampex equipment out in Los Angeles near the Ampex factory.
Oh, wow.
And he did all kinds of major duplicating stuff for Ampex, and he has that equipment that he would like to donate somewhere. It's probably $500,000 worth of equipment. And he called me the other day after he saw this promotion and stuff saying, you know, maybe I was going to sell it, but maybe I need to donate. And I was going, you know, Ron, we really don't have any room for anything like that big equipment.
God, it's almost like, man, if there's any studio guys that we know out there that listen to this show, if you have room, maybe they could house it for you until you get the space.
Yeah, that's
like,
possible,
Jesus.
Too. Somebody said,
you don't want to lose any of this stuff. This is bumming me out.
Some of the storage companies, too, somebody suggested might come forward and help us where we didn't have to lease storage space. We might find something. But, and Ron Newdall, who had Accurate Sound in San Angelo, is now doing solar, moved into solar, which is probably a good move on his part.
Right. So this Indiegogo campaign goes until August 31st. Am I right?
It's 45 days. I think it ends the middle of August. We're thinking about expanding it 60 days so it goes through the 1st of September. A lot of people, we launched it around 4th of July, and I mean, people are probably just scattered all over the place. So
yeah.
I think if we could get through 60 days, we'd probably do better.
Sure, and people can go to momsr.org.
Yes.
.org.
And they'll see a big banner there saying help.
Yeah, and they can also really, I mean, it's a very good website. It's very thorough. There's a lot of, you can kind of get lost in there.
Yeah.
Especially if you are like a nerd.
Yes.
For, like, I mean, I really did spend like the, I was just kind of like, wow.
Well,
this morning, I was just kind of freaking out in it.
What?
How many hits do you get?
Yeah, we get 1.5 million hits on it. And
are
the
you
other
kidding
we,
me?
No.
That's
a
amazing.
Month. Yeah. It was funny to
us.
When KXAN first came out to do a story on the museum, they said, we need about 20 minutes. It takes about 10 minutes to set up, 20 minutes to talk to you. 4 hours later, they left. It's like, it was really fun. It was really fun. And the tours are fun. We can't do too many. I mean, it's a private residence, too. But we will let people come out, and we'll give a tour. We've got one of the neat things is when we first got started on the collection, Chris gave me a book by Phil Van Prague that documented the evolution of the audio recorder. And it was just a Bible. I carried it to England on vacation. I've worn it out. I've carried it for 15 years now, I guess. He's coming Wednesday to tour the museum, and I'm so excited to get to meet him and do that because it's fun. He's a cool person. He wrote the book, and I loved his intro. He says, so Mrs. James, I think was her name, was my English teacher in college and said, you're such a good writer, I'll read anything you write. We'll see. Because he really documented all the recording companies and everything. That's been fun, too, to document the manufacturers of the equipment. I mean, it's amazing how they evolved and stuff. Ampex was building motors for radar installations in World War II, and then trying to find something to do. And Bing Crosby sent them a $50,000 check to build the recorders. So it's like,
Great.
It's just the whole thing is a fascinating history.
Yeah, fantastic history. Is there so people can go to momsr.org, and then you can go to the Indiegogo campaign project from there. Oh, it's up till August 20th.
Yeah,
there we go. Okay,
I bet we can
but
expand.
It'll probably expand.
Go to September 5th, I think, will be the final day. And they can also do the survey. There's also a link there for the survey, which is still active. And we've had some really great responses. I mean, the worldwide response is just people would love to get here and go through this. It's really fun.
Let's get this. Let's do that.
Thank you.
Chris and Martin Theophilus.
Thank you.
But you have a great name for a guy to have a museum. You know what I mean? Martin Theophilus.
Theophilus means lover of God.
And really?
Chris's name is Christine Mary Theophilus. I mean, that's serious stuff.
That's some serious stuff.
But I can't believe that she threw in with me totally. She managed musicians. She's done.
You got into it, huh?
Yeah, she did. She can shoot video. One final aside, I got to tell you.
Please.
I thought that I wanted to do something for Chris's birthday quite a long time ago, late 80s. And she liked hot air balloons. And I thought, I'll give her a hot air balloon ride. So I checked into it. I couldn't afford it. So I saw that Austin Community College was giving a class in hot air balloons. So I gave her the class, and I shot video. And the instructor turned out to be the barbecue owner that catered our wedding, Railroad Barbecue, Dan Sherrill. He said, that's a great video. Let's do a crew training video. So we did a crew training video for him. And it turns out we have now, between all the things that he's done and the events he did, we've done the Washington Andrews Air Force Base air show with Kodak. We've done the Maryland Preakness. We've documented the balloon factories in England. We've spent 10 days in Mexico. She's had about 50 balloon rides out of that ACC class, and shot video, chased balloons, shot bands, managed bands. I mean, yeah.
That's almost like a give a man a fish, or you can teach a man to fish.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You can give her a balloon ride or teach her.
But that support, none of this would all happen. But she's got her horses. I get my studio, she's got her horses.
Well, good. Well, I want to come tour the facility.
Please.
Or just the room, or what, man.
It's, it's three rooms.
Three rooms.
It's migrated downstairs. Yeah, I know. It needs the place.
Well, I don't even have a dining room. I mean, if I had even cooler stuff, I wouldn't stop filling it up. Well, thank you guys for coming out. People should get involved. Get out there. All of my audiophile listeners, get involved, because this is something that people would definitely want to do.
And Austin needs it. God, Austin needs
it. Yeah, Austin needs it. Austin does need it. It'd be a great attraction.
It would be.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. Martin Theophilus, the Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording, man, you're going to want to do that. Get over there and check it out. MOMSR.org. Give to them and help them get it going, all right? Listen, while you're out there on the internet looking them up, go to our iTunes page and you can subscribe to this podcast. Or you can also, listen to us on Stitcher. You can add us to your favorite stations, and then every time a new one's up, you'll be notified. Hey, there's a new How Did I Get Here up, okay? So you can do that or subscribe on iTunes. And you can go to our Facebook page and like it. You will find out what's going on. There are photos of me with my guests and photos and things I say, and also updates from other guests that, I think that are appropriate to pass along to you guys, the listener. And you can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy, okay? Thank you so much for listening to the show. Let's get out there and help the Museum of Magnetic Sound Recording. Martin and Chris Theophilus, thank you so much for coming by and sitting down and talking to me. MOMSR.org. Get out there, check out their Indiegogo campaign, and give to them. Let's get this going. You guys have a great weekend. Woo! End of July. It's all happening, isn't it? Damn. I hope you guys have a great one. Let's get down.